Good morning and welcome to the Filson Historical Society. I'm Mark Wetherington, director, and we want to begin promptly and enjoy our day together. This is our sixth academic conference at the Filson Institute. It is entitled, as you know, The Hard Hand of War, Irregulars and Civilians in the Civil War. And we had a wonderful time last night together and heard a very interesting keynote by Leanne White. And we're delighted to have you all here today. How many of you got here last night? Great. A really strong turnout. And this is a strong turnout this morning. So thank you for choosing to spend your time with us here at the Filson Institute. Before I introduce our first commenter, let me say that on the desk in the stairwell outside will be a stack of fellows applications. And if you've never applied for an application here to do research at the Filson, I would really invite you to do that. If you have a topic that is in the Ohio Valley region in general, and we define that fairly broadly as basically the watershed of the Ohio Valley and the Ohio River. So it's a large region. It's not quite as large as Leanne's two departments of the Missouri and Ohio, but it's getting almost that large. So give it a look, and if you have graduate students coming on, both at the master's level and doing a doctoral dissertation, we have some great resources here to help you. And we look forward to starting the receipt of applications again basically a year from now, October of 2016, because of construction and a project going on out back with the campus expansion. It's very exciting. I mentioned last night the next call for papers, they happen every 2 years, will be in the new Owsley Brown II History Center right beyond the carriage house. You can look through the wall and see the foundation going up right now. So it's very, very exciting. Without further delay, our first panel is entitled Guerrillas. And I'm very pleased to introduce Megan Kate Nelson, who is currently a writer and blogger at www.historista.com. Last year, she was a visiting assistant professor of history at Brown University. She received her PhD in American Studies at the University of Iowa and her MAB in History and Literature at Harvard University. Her books include Ruined Nation, Destruction and the American Civil War, which was a finalist for the Jefferson Davis Book Award, the Museum of the Confederacy, and Trembling Earth, A Cultural History of the Okefenokee Swamp. She has just returned from the Southwest on a research trip where she has been looking for additional sources and information on her book in progress, Path of the Dead Man, The Civil War in the Desert Southwest. So please join me in welcoming Megan Kate Nelson, who will introduce this panel.
Thank you, and thank you guys so much for coming here so early in the morning, fortified by coffee, I am sure. I'm going to introduce each of our panelists right before they give their papers, so I will introduce Andrew first and then give my comment after. And in keeping with the irregular theme of this conference, my introduction will include things both true and untrue about our panelists, so it's up to you to determine which those are. Andrew Fiaga is a graduate student in history at the University of Georgia and has studied with both of our conveners, Leanne White at the University of Missouri as an undergraduate and with Aaron Chiandine as a master's student at West Virginia. When he is not inputting data to determine spatiotemporal patterns, he is playing drums in his rock band, Andre and the Giants. He tried out to be a punter for the University of Kansas football team. He did not make it. Therefore, he made a run for the border and to Mizzou. Also, he once lit his backyard on fire. Accidentally, of course. The title of his paper today is Controlled Chaos, Spatiotemporal Patterns Within Missouri's Irregular Civil War.
thank you, Megan, for the introduction. Thank you all for coming. I am the poor soul that has to follow Leanne's keynote address, so I think she did that on purpose to me. I'd like to start today by reading a quote and asking you all to really focus on creating a mental image. Paint a vivid picture in your mind of the quote I'm about to read. It's important to how I'm going to start this thing. Here we go. At the Battle of Spotsylvania Courthouse in May of 1864, Private Thomas Roche witnessed a fellow Confederate throw down his musket and pick up a hatchet. As a Federal came at him with a bayonet, he pushed it aside with his left hand, while with the hatchet in his right hand, he brained his opponent. The Federals shrank from the sickening scene. So it's only fair that I share my mental image of this as well. This is a bit embarrassing and a little bit gory, so you've been warned. This is from a popular TV show right now, and it's a little silly, but it's not ridiculous. If this is a Confederate, this is close to a hatchet. I don't know what brand is, but I'm pretty sure this is close here. And this guy is very sickened by the scene. So that's what I thought of. My point is, historians who analyze disturbing accounts such as Roche's do so in the larger context of battle, right? Individually, Roche's rendition of the fighting at Spotsylvania seems very vicious. However, when cartographers inscribe Roche in a square labeled 16th Mississippi, his regiment, and place that square in a battle line on a map, Roche's individual report melds into the overall strategy of Robert E. Lee. Geographically speaking, a map's expansive scale allows historians to interpret evidence in different ways. Roche's brutal actions give way to Lee's tactical genius when viewed on a larger scale. Okay, same battle. This is Spotsylvania Courthouse. Zach and I actually worked as park rangers at this park a few summers ago. But this is how we're trained to start when we give the public tours. We start with a map, or we start with a picture, because maps make sense. This does not make any sense to a lot of people. So maps can tease out order from chaos. They're very good at that. So my main contention today, what I'll be talking about the whole time, is that historians must also place guerrilla warfare on a map in order for us to fully comprehend the irregular side of the Civil War. This contention then begs the question, why haven't we done this already? It's pretty simple. Just look at this map. This happens on a battlefield that you can draw a nice square around. It also happens in circumscribed time frames. The guerrilla war does not develop this way. Guerrillas operated on horseback, wherever their horses could carry them. They operated at all hours of the day and night. Their tactics depended on stealth, speed, secrecy, and surprise. So a static map like this that looks really good on the wall or really good in a book does not work for the guerrilla war, because the time frame and the space over which guerrillas operated is just too big. It's way too big. As a result, what we do have in the historiography of guerrilla warfare is what I call an anecdotal approach, which is it's very good at richly depicting how Union soldiers and individual civilians experienced irregular warfare. What we don't have is a model of irregular warfare that considers guerrillas' actions in relation to one another, to the Union Army's location and force, to guerrillas' domestic supply line, or to the terrain and time in which guerrillas operated. In short, guerrilla warfare has been seen as chaotic and disorganized, as if there were no patterns within it. So, this paper makes two overarching claims. The first one is a methodological claim. Digital mapping programs enable historians to place guerrilla warfare on a map, finally. And that's what I did. This is a program called ArcGIS. I'll explain this rather quickly. Think of an animated map that moves through time, okay? This is the state of Missouri. All these little dots are places the Union Army was at. The best way to think about this quickly is a flip book, okay? And each page of the flip book is a day in the Civil War. And each page of the flip book has this map on it. So if this regiment was here from January 1st to January 31st, 1861, I tell the computer, only display that dot from January 1st to January 31st. So when you flip through, you only see where the Union Army was in that space during the time they were there. Make sense? Okay. You can make really cool movies with this. I didn't do it today because even though I spent the time to make it, it takes way too long to show a movie, and it doesn't give you a whole lot of analysis. My second claim is that by using this methodology, I've discovered that instances of guerrilla violence were concentrated in predictable locations in conjunction with the temporal presence of Unionist militias and conventional armies. Consequently, I argue that guerrillas were not disorganized, but that they were opportunists. They chiefly targeted Union war industries. This includes railroads, telegraph lines, supply trains, small outfits of Union troops, small garrisons, Unionist militias, and Unionist home guards. More simply put, viewing the guerrilla war through a spatio-temporal lens allows historians to reinterpret seemingly chaotic events and uncover an organized infrastructure and clear intent behind guerrilla's savage actions. The maps in my presentation today specifically focus on the correlation between instances of guerrilla violence and the spatial and temporal locations of the Union Army and Civil War Missouri in order to reveal guerrilla's order and intent. Three major patterns emerge when we look at Missouri's guerrilla war with this lens. The first one is that differing Union occupational strategies foreshadowed patterns of guerrilla violence. So I went through my sources and I categorized instances of Union occupation as either stationary or temporary, depending on how long they were in a place and depending on how long the source described them. So if a Union army is stationed somewhere or is permanently placed somewhere, I categorize it as stationary. If they're on a raid or a scout or something like that, I categorize it as temporary. Stationary occupation effectively quelled guerrilla violence. Temporary occupation acted as magnets for violence and instigated guerrillas. So depending on the form of Union occupation, it can either increase guerrilla violence or decrease it. The second thing, guerrillas practiced statewide interconnectivity by organizing the resources across county lines against the Union's chief threats. And last, guerrillas openly cooperated with the Confederacy's standing army and ultimately depended on the conventional war's outcome. For my first point, a comparison between the city of St. Louis and Missouri's central counties illustrates the protective effects of stationary occupation and the destructive effects of temporary occupation. The large urban center of St. Louis boasted a population of over 160,000 people. It contained a federal arsenal, multiple barracks, hospitals, prisons, and a largely Unionist German-American citizenry. In addition, the city's location at the junction of the Missouri and Mississippi rivers made it a strategic military point. The Union stationed between 2 and 6 regiments within city limits from June 12, 1861 to June 1, 1865, and never abandoned their occupation of the city. As a result, few instances of guerrilla violence occurred in the surrounding counties of St. Louis, and almost none penetrated the city's limits. Ultimately, for St. Louis residents, a continual Union presence served as a zone of protection against guerrillas for the entirety of the war. In contrast, most civilians in Missouri's central counties suffered from violent guerrilla warfare due to temporary and inconsistent Union occupation after 1861. You can't see that very well, can you? These are the central counties in Missouri. So if this is the state outline, these are the ones right in the middle. Important things to note here are the river. This is what Leanne last night told you was called.
called Little Dixie. These are a lot of counties in Little Dixie. And then there's one railroad here that follows the river and one that goes north of it and hooks up with a railroad that kind of spans the top of the state.
Central Missouri counties experienced sporadic federal expeditions, contained no large garrison towns, and witnessed a mass exodus of Union troops beginning in 1862. The mercurial presence of Union armies in Missouri's central counties created large numbers of company-sized skeleton crews and Union supply trains that were unable to offer protection to civilians and actually became targets for guerrillas. Moreover, Missouri's location on the western frontier distanced the state from most Confederate and Union strongholds. While the Union military stationed some regiments in towns for months on end, a majority of soldiers manned temporary locations for only days or weeks at a time, and no town played host to the Union Army for the entirety of the war. So, to show you how the map sort of illustrates this point, I tried to condense it down into charts and graphs instead of showing a movie. So, here are two charts that kind of make my point. These are counties, this is just a shade map, counties that experienced temporary Union occupation. So this doesn't show the stationary points of Union occupation. As you can see, it's concentrated in Little Dixie, especially in the west, and then along sort of the railroads, and at the end of these railroad lines, a little bit in the southwest, a little bit in the southeast, and then at these railroad hubs here. Instances of guerrilla violence in the state follow a very similar pattern, especially in the western counties, especially in Little Dixie, at the end of these two railroad lines, and in the southwest. Now, what's really cool about ArcGIS is that you can put maps on top of each other, okay, as many layers as you want. So a lot of the sources that tell us about guerrilla violence will just say a county where guerrillas were operating, but in some instances, they actually had a city. Okay, so the X's that are in the circles here are the cities that experienced guerrilla violence, and then in the background is that temporary Union occupation map. Okay, so you can see here where the guerrillas are attacking. They're attacking along the river. They're attacking in these counties that are have a heavy concentration of temporary Union occupation, and they're attacking along the railroads. I wish I would have made these maps bigger now. Also, a little quantitative analysis. This isn't extremely important, but it just shows you this ratio on the left is stationary to temporary occupation. So you can see at the beginning of the war, the Union Army is really trying to have big garrisons that stay somewhere for a long time, and then it switches. And they start doing more of these expeditions, scouting campaigns, and all these things instead of having big garrisons. And guerrillas, from left to right, when guerrillas are targeting the Union and when they're targeting civilians. So you can see they're ramping up. They are targeting civilians, but they're targeting the Union Army much more. And they're targeting the Union Army more as the Union Army is using temporary occupational strategies. So the biggest takeaway from this analysis is that a vast majority of guerrilla violence occurred in those areas previously associated with temporary Union occupation and against Union targets. Okay? My second contention, go back to that, is that the spatial-temporal presence of guerrilla activity demonstrates irregulars' organizational skills. As an example, let's look at actions in 1863. In the spring of 1863, General Thomas Ewing Jr., who was then commanding the Missouri-Kansas border, vowed to root out the bushwhacker problem in that region of the state. In order to do so, he first concentrated Union forces in Missouri's western counties. Next, he targeted, jailed, and even banished guerrillas' aiders and abettors, including their female family members. On August 13th, a Kansas City jail collapsed on several of these guerrillas' relatives. Four women were killed, and eight others were severely wounded. The very next day after this jail collapsed, Ewing signed into law General Orders No. 10, which called for, quote, the forced removal of bushwhacker families and friends and their exile from West Missouri. Get out of our state. That's basically what he's saying. So, again, I culled evidence from the digitized map to see how guerrillas responded to Ewing's policies in 1863. Okay, the red is western counties. The brown is central counties. These two bars are instances of Union occupation, and these two bars are instances of guerrilla violence. So you can see Ewing is trying to pull everybody into the western counties. These bars are even, pretty much even, for other years of the war. And what's shocking is that the guerrilla violence follows the Union Army. Four of these six instances are in a county that's on the border of what I can't categorize as western and central. So it's very heavily slanted to the western counties. Also, in 1863, again, Leanne talked about this last night, the guerrillas, between 300 and 450 guerrillas sacked Lawrence, Kansas. Joe Beeline has positively identified 93 guerrillas in these two areas of the state. Now, there's a lot more guerrillas than that, but those are the guerrillas that he can find in multiple sources and positively say that we definitely know these guys were here. So between 300 and 450 is a huge number and shows that these guerrillas are coming together from different counties to enact the same goals. My final point is that guerrilla activity in Missouri developed in the context of the larger war. The fate of Missouri's southern sympathizing civilians was inextricably tied to that of the Confederacy. Guerrillas understood that ultimately the protection of their households and their larger slave society rested not with them, but with the regular Confederate Army. As an example, I'll briefly discuss Confederate General Sterling Price's 1864 raid through Missouri, which shaped guerrillas' actions in the state for the remainder of the war. This is a map of Price's raid. A few things to note. He starts down here in Arkansas, tries to get to St. Louis, doesn't quite make it, tries to take Kansas City instead, gets beat, quickly retreats back down to Arkansas. This happens, this says September 27th, this says October 25th. This happens in less than a month. Okay? So, how does Price's presence in Missouri for a month link guerrillas' actions to the Confederate Army? Again, there's three reasons. The first one is that Price's strategy was to take St. Louis. That was the crown jewel of the state and the only really strategic military point. And he knew that doing so wholly depended on Missouri citizens swelling his relatively small force of 12,000 men. He needed more men, and he thought if he went through the state, all these guerrillas and all these southern civilians would join him. Second point here is that guerrillas did actively cooperate with General Price. The most notorious guerrillas in the state, Bill Anderson, William Quatrill, Samuel Hildebrand, all received orders from Price and all carried them out in their own guerrilla way. Still, there were not tens of thousands of guerrillas or civilians that joined him that would be needed to take a garrison town like St. Louis. Lastly, and most importantly, after Price retreated from Missouri, guerrilla activity decreases rapidly. The numbers are, there's something like 20-something instances of guerrilla violence in Missouri after Price's exit and the sources I looked at, and there were, you know, over 100 in 1864 before he got there. Guerrillas stopped operating because their goals mirrored Price's goals. Price's failed attempt to take St. Louis registered defeat in the eyes of a vast majority of guerrillas because he was widely considered the last hope for a Confederate Missouri. Missouri's guerrillas fought for the same things Price and his men fought for, and Price's loss was the guerrillas' loss. So, comparing spatiotemporal analyses of St. Louis, Western, and Central Missouri helps us think about the Civil War as a regular conflict in new ways. Most importantly, patterns of guerrilla violence existed within the state. The presence of Union occupiers and Confederate armies directly influenced the presence of guerrilla warfare. Furthermore, guerrillas' cross-county organizational abilities in assaulting the Union war machine illustrates an ideological underpinning concurrent with regular Confederate soldiers. These findings add clarity to historians' current definition of guerrilla warfare by illuminating aim, intent, and purpose to guerrillas' violent actions. They also demonstrate the usefulness of digital methodologies and of mapping as a way to incorporate a spatial approach with historians' already very effective social, military, cultural, and gendered methods to better understand the past. Thank you very much, and if you want to see, this project is always updating. I'm always adding new sources. ehistory.org is the site where this is hosted, and you can see the full map. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you very much. Okay, our next panelist is Joseph Beline Jr., who is assistant professor of history at Penn State Erie, the Berend College. He earned his PhD in history from the University of Missouri, Columbia, in 2012, working with Leanne Weitz. Joe is a man of many talents. He is a deep-sea fisherman. He created a wedding gown exhibit at the Missouri Historical Society. And he once appeared in an off-off-off Broadway production of Riverdance. Today, Joe's paper examines men, horses, and the tactical advantages of guerrilla warfare.
Introduction, Megan. It was a great honor to be cast in Riverdance. Not everybody can do that. Also, I'd like to thank Andrew for setting this panel up, and of course, thank the Filson for inviting us here to talk about guerrillas. Today, I'm going to talk about the relationship between men and their horses. So we're going from Andrew's sort of big bird's eye view of the war to a very small, tiny view of the war. Basically, the perspective of the mounted guerrilla on his horse. And of course, talking about horses in Kentucky is just a fantastic thing, right? I expect all of you to tell me that I'm kind of wrong on a lot of things, and then fill me in, you know, help me out, if you will. In the spring of 1865, William Clark Quantrell left his stomping grounds in Missouri for Kentucky, where both he and his horse would die. William E. Connolly, one of the first historians of the guerrilla war, drew a direct connection between the death of Quantrell and the death of his horse. In his book, Quantrell and the Border Wars, he claimed that the horse, whose name was Charlie, which is a very popular name at the time for horses, became a part of Quantrell, and the guerrillas believed he absorbed the nature of his master and became a guerrilla. They thought that the horse was, quote, the best guard in camp, and sounded many an alarm that saved the guerrilla band. Connolly was so sure that the horse did absorb the nature of Quantrell because, quote, Charlie became vicious. He would strike, bite, kick, and squeal if approached by others. However, while Quantrell and his band were resting one day in Kentucky, the guerrilla blacksmith, Jack Graham, and of course the guerrillas would have a blacksmith with them at all times, set about shoeing Charlie. In the process of paring the horse's hooves, Graham struggled with Charlie and left him hamstrung. He ruined the horse. When he heard of the incident, Quantrell read it as a sign of his own demise. Indeed, the guerrilla chief was mortally wounded shortly after his beloved horse was destroyed. Now, in my talk today, we're going to come to find out why Quantrell would think the death of his horse would mean his possible demise. And do you guys know where Quantrell was killed? not far away, and then he was dragged up here to Louisville to suffer for like a month and then die and convert to Catholicism, which I always thought was a strange turn there. Strange turn. And this is someone who was born and raised Catholic, but you know. Without a horse, a man could not be a gorilla, and in the brush, a man who was not a gorilla was as good as dead. At the center of both the myths and reality of the guerrilla war was the mounted man. The guerrillas imagined themselves as chivalric knights in the same mold as Sir Walter Scott's dashing heroes of medieval Europe, but they could only do so as long as they were astride a charging mount. There was nothing romantic or dashing about trudging on foot for miles and miles along rutted roads, through the mud, over hills, and across streams. Marching was below these young men from the best families of Missouri, and that's, you know, what they thought of themselves. Tapping into this romantic imagery of Scott, Hamp Watts, who was a young guerrilla that fought with Bloody Bill Anderson in 1864, painted quite the image of his cohort. He remembered that, quote, when in a line, mounted on the finest horses, the band certainly gave a, quote, knightly appearance. More than just an attempt to embody the characters of a fabled past, the use of horses made the men who fought as guerrillas into elite soldiers for their time. Going to war on thoroughbred and in Missouri also Arabian horses, they were sort of mixing these two types of horses, quite literally made the guerrillas superhuman. Whether they were fighting foot soldiers or novice Union cavalrymen, the guerrillas' mastery of their animals gave them an incredible advantage in speed, strength, size, maneuverability, and power on both the tactical and strategic levels. Horses made the guerrilla war possible, made the guerrillas men, and propelled them into the realm of legend. Now, if you'll take a peek at the handout I gave you, I don't want you guys to be too judgmental of this drawing because I was up all night in the hotel room last night working on this. I kept Andrew up. It was great. No, but this is a picture that Hamp Babe Watts, who I just quoted, drew for the front piece of his memoir. So the memoir opens, and this is the first thing that you see. And I think it's really interesting because, I mean, sure, it's an 80-year-old man who sat down to draw this, which is really kind of this sweet, sweet moment. But I think what he's trying to do, he's trying to convey the idea of how significant these horses were. What pictures we do have of the guerrillas during the war are all of them sitting in these portrait studios, right, with these strange classical backgrounds draped behind them. And we don't have any images of what they were like in action, what they were like as horsemen. And you can see here, you know, it's clearly like he's got like his hand in the air and the big plume on his hat. And I love the little heart on his saddle back there. Yeah. So these men loved their horses, and of course, you know, even 50, 60 years after the war, they're imagining themselves as these dashing sort of heroic characters. Despite the seemingly fundamental nature of horses to guerrilla warfare, historians have not examined the role of horses in the war in very much depth. Some historians have remarked on the anecdotal fact that all of the guerrillas were mounted. However, what that meant in the terms of how the guerrillas fought or what role the horses might have played in the outcome of the war has escaped historical discussion. When the subject is broadened to the role of the horse in the Civil War more generally, military historians contend that cavalry was much less of a factor in the Civil War than it had been in previous conflicts. Some historians even assert that the horse had been rather insignificant in combat for some time, going back to the Napoleonic age. However, works that attempt to understand the significance of the horse within antebellum culture suggest that the horse remained important during the war, if only as a romantic symbol of chivalry. Indeed, the horse was an important symbol for the guerrillas, but it was hardly an empty one. By embracing important components of antebellum manhood, notably mastery and horsemanship, the guerrillas turned an important part of their culture into a great tactical and strategic advantage during the war. Now, by the war, Missouri had become something of a horse culture, and it was a horse culture on the levels of states like Kentucky and Virginia, which I think that resonates with us, right? Kentucky, Virginia, horse culture, that makes sense. We rarely think of Missouri in the same context. Some of the ways in which horses played a central role in Missouri society were through their use in ranging. So early in the state's history and before the state's history, famously, Daniel Boone's sons, you know, would use their horses to range the entire Missouri River across all the way to where, what is now the western part of the state, on the lookout for Native Americans, for Indians. And there was blockhouses set up and everything like that. Horses were also used in the slave patrols, right? Every one of these counties and even townships in Little Dixie had their own slave patrol, and the horses were an important part of that. They were used in hunting, and of course they were used in horse racing. And if you look through some of the antebellum newspapers, sorry, no, not yet. We'll get there. You find all these great accounts of these horse races that took place. And has anyone looked at the newspapers in Kentucky or these horse races that took place before there was like formal horse racing and betting? It's these fascinating things because there's these very contrived, like, we'll race from my house to so-and-so's house 13 miles away, but you have to go across this bridge and that bridge, and everybody takes bets. And there's this great account. It's the name of the article was The Great Race, and it comes from the Liberty Tribune in 1854. But it talks about how this race between Dr. J.C. Tiffin and W.H. Ballard of Ray County, which is a western county, was the great race of the season, and how they marked out this 15-mile course, and then all the other planters come in and take side bets, and they're betting their own horses, and in the end, who was it that won? Ballard wins, and the secret was he left water stations along the way. Right. But that was like, you know, that created some controversy. But clearly, though, horse racing, horse culture has taken hold in Missouri. And as a side note, do you guys know who the founder of Churchill Downs and the Louisville Jockey Club was? Come on, Kentuckians. It was Meriwether Lewis Clark Jr., who, of course, is a Missourian, and his mother was Abigail Churchill. So he came back this way after the war. He fought for the Confederacy. He came back this way and founded the Jockey Club. And then it's called Churchill Downs because, of course, those were like his cousins, you know, and it was their land. Anyway. The great popularity of the animal made horse mastery a necessary element for white manhood. In addition to, of course, the various qualitative pieces of evidence for horse culture, we have this quantitative evidence. And if you turn your little handout over, these are sort of crude numbers, but you can see Missouri has more horses than Kentucky or Virginia. Which I'm not saying that they were more of a horse culture than in either of those states, but they had more horses, and they also had a smaller white population. So they have a large number of horses for a smaller number of white people. In addition to that, some of the major counties where guerrilla warfare took place, Jackson County, Howard County, Sheridan County, Boone County, they all have these large horse populations. Now, to give some context for these counties, Jefferson County, Kentucky, where we are now, in 1860, they had 5,915 horses. Okay, so I think that puts those numbers in context. Fayette County, where Lexington is, had 8,233 horses. So they're on par with these more notable horse cultures. Additionally, the individual households that supported the guerrillas had high numbers of horses. So if you look down at the bottom chart there, some of these households, like the Morgan Walker household, Cole Younger's household, had upwards of 25, 30 horses. But the average number of horses per household that supported the guerrillas that I've positively identified was just over 7, about 7.2. It's a pretty large number of horses. These were wealthy people. In speaking of the men who grew up in Missouri and became guerrillas, Joseph Bailey, who was a guerrilla, echoed what many guerrillas would have believed when he said, as a rule, we were all superb horsemen, right? And you definitely get this vibe from the culture that's been created that you had to be a superb horseman to grow up and be a man in this culture. Once in the brush, the guerrillas would prepare their horses for combat. Andrew Walker, who is the son of Morgan Walker, and one of Quantrell's early devotees, recalled that, quote, on coming into possession of a new animal, the first thing a bushwhacker would do was to break him by leaping fences, logs, and gullies, and traversing rough ground. This was done so that they would not fail the guerrillas in an emergency. And of course, this is, they're actively mastering these horses as they pick them up, you know, in the brush. And they oftentimes, as Leanne pointed out and Andrew alluded to, they're getting them from friends, right? Oftentimes they'd be riding a tired horse and they'd go and exchange them for a rested, well-fed horse from a friend. More than any other element, the horse made guerrilla warfare possible. For instance, the scatter technique was especially popular among the guerrillas, and the horse was key to this. Harrison Trow, who was a guerrilla with Quantrell, recalled that, quote, "It was a part of Quantrell's tactics to disband every now and then." Trow remembered Quantrell saying that, quote, "Scattered soldiers make a scattered trail. The regiment that has but one man to hunt can never find him." The ability of the guerrillas to harness the full potential of his animal's speed and mobility made such a tactic possible. Individual men on horseback could outrun the more structured groups of Union horsemen who tried to maintain their tight formation throughout the chase. Many of these free-willing horsemen scattered throughout the brush, riding in every direction, added confusion to the already challenging task facing their Union pursuers. Union General Thomas Ewing, who we've already gotten a mention of today, was all too aware of the deadly nature of this tactic. He said of the guerrillas, "When assembled in a body of several hundred, they scatter before an inferior force, and when troops scatter in pursuit, they reassemble and fall on an exposed squad or weakened post." Because of their mastery of the horse, the guerrillas were able to put distance between themselves and their pursuers and turn a successful retreat into an even more successful ambush. In addition to the great tactical advantage that the horse provided the guerrillas, it also made them difficult to kill. A mounted guerrilla was able to make the most of his one life. Guerrilla strategy intended to string out the conflict, making it a long, costly, and deflating proposition for their Union enemies. At the risk of stating what would seem quite obvious, if you're going to employ a strategy like that, it's really important that you are able to continue fighting. And if you want to continue fighting, you have to stay alive, right? It's detrimental to the cause to go charging headlong and wiping everyone out, because then the war is over. Because of both the limitations of many of the firearms used against the guerrillas, I think of like the musket, you know, firing 20, 30 seconds later, as well as the densely wooded landscape, the horse made it very easy for a guerrilla who's in combat to escape combat and get away from his enemies, his pursuers, and find a hiding place. After the Union turned to the bloodier strategy of no quarter in the spring of 1862, which we heard about last night, the horse became even more valuable. In other words, when the Union no longer was pursuing conquest, pacification, or assimilation, but instead was pursuing the actual killing of individual men, the ability to escape death becomes a very important act of resistance, right? It's resistance itself to stay alive when you are the target. Knowing that it was possible to escape even the deadliest situation could instill a spirit of invincibility in the heart of the guerrilla. At its best, this cockiness, and that's exactly what it was, refer to the drawing, hand up, astride his mount. This cockiness manifested itself in poise and coolness during a deadly firefight. It gave the men courage and daring to charge into the flank of a larger enemy force. In 1861, when Quantrell was confronted with the reality that a price had been put on his head and that he would be pursued by hundreds of Union troopers, he did not shrink from the moment. Instead, he calmly remarked to Andrew Walker, "They can't catch me." Furthermore, given the uncertainty of war, any war, and the guerrilla's own perception that they were fighting against long odds, this aspect of self-assurance in the collective personality created a positive outlook in their day-to-day existence. Although it is very difficult to gauge the guerrilla's collective morale throughout the war, it seems that they were generally optimistic, and I mean optimistic for soldiers. I don't mean optimistic for us who woke up in our nice, comfy beds and had coffee, for soldiers. Humor admittedly dark humor permeates the small amount of wartime record that exists and appears frequently in the post-war narratives. Whereas the Civil War was a crushing experience for many men, especially those who experienced the war as rank-and-file infantrymen, the guerrillas' mastery of the horse seemed to give them a better chance to master themselves in the face of combat and fear. In addition to the more obvious physical and psychological advantages they gave their riders, a horse's instincts could prove useful to the guerrillas. Once in the brush, the guerrillas often discovered these unintended benefits of having their horses with them. Most notable ones were oftentimes when they would lay down to go to sleep at night, the guerrillas would post guards until they realized that the horses had better hearing and better sight than they did. So a lot of these guerrillas, especially when they were in small groups, would go to sleep knowing that their horses would be spooked if anyone came near them, which I think is pretty impressive. Of course, the advantages that the horse provided were not without their costs. They obviously had to rest their horses, feed their horses, water their horses, and oftentimes, according to the guerrillas, they would do this often without feeding themselves, watering themselves, right? Resting themselves. They would let their horses rest while they stood guard. So they had this sort of symbiotic relationship. John Newman Edwards, who was the first person to write a history of the guerrilla war, and I put history in quotes as Matt Hulbert laughs over there, offered a powerful, if romantic, description of Quantrell. In his 1877 book, Noted Guerrillas, which was as much post-war propaganda, pro-guerrilla, pro-South propaganda, as it was a history, he said that the guerrilla chieftain was, quote, a living, breathing, aggressive, all-powerful reality, riding through the midnight, laying ambushes by lonesome roadsides, catching marching columns by the throat, breaking in upon the flanks and tearing a suddenly surprised rear to pieces, vigilant, merciless, a terror by day, and a superhuman, if not supernatural being, when there was upon the earth blackness and darkness. Whatever criticism has been directed at Edwards for his lost cause message, literary flourish, and mythologizing, this passage should not be completely dismissed as fanciful imagery. That's all right, man. It's time for me to wrap this up anyway. The midnight rider Edwards sought to describe was more than Quantrell and more than just any man. This all-powerful reality was two separate beings fused together, man and horse. He was the guerrilla, and in Edwards' mind, he was war incarnate. However, without the horse, there would be no guerrilla. Indeed, I think it's fair to conclude that without the horse, there would be no guerrilla war. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Joe. So our final panelist is Zachary Kausert, who is a PhD candidate in history at West Virginia University, where he earned his master's studying with Aaron Sheehan Dean. Here's an interesting thing about Zach. He won the Fairfax County Cakewalk 4 times consecutively. So weird. No one else has ever done that. It's record setting. Totally wacko. He has a fantasy football team called the Cavalry, which, by his own account, is no threat to anyone else in the league. And he came to Civil War studies through the reenactment circuit in Oklahoma. I'm hoping there will be questions about that later. This morning, Zach will be telling us about violence and suffering in Indian territory.
I want to begin today, well, of course, I want to thank you all for allowing me to be here and for putting this panel together. I will admit I'm a little bit, I think, of the black sheep of this panel because I'm not really talking about guerrillas, but I'm going to keep us in the Trans-Mississippi, in the borderlands, and in fact, I'm going to carry you away today west to Indian Territory, the Indian Territory, modern-day Oklahoma. So stay flexible with me as we go. In the heart of the cold winter of 1861 and 1862, a young Creek Indian girl stood on a hilltop in Northeast Indian Territory and gazed upon the chaotic scene below her. 10-year-old Smatty Pigeon watched as Confederate cavalrymen caught up to her party of Indian refugees. She would relate the memorable scene to her son years later. Her party of Indians was, quote, overtaken and had refuge on a hill while groups of men had stopped along the way to check the rear attackers. At dark, as the firing kept on, the scene seemed to be like the flicker of fireflies, with report of guns heard and flashes here and there of the shooting. Despite the Southern troopers' best attempts, Smatty Pigeon escaped the hilltop that night and made her way north to Union, Kansas. Yet this single incident of terror provides a moment of insight into the trials and tribulations of thousands of Creek and Seminole Indians who rejected Confederate authority and instead made a long, perilous trek north in the winter of 61 and 62. And hopefully, by now you've gleaned that my topic today examines one of the least known and perhaps most tragic episodes of the Civil War, the 1861 Confederate offensive against Creek Chief Apothleohola and his followers in Indian Territory. And it is a tale that I'm hoping will illuminate some fresh insights on hard war, the concept of hard war, that it boils over far from centers of political power. And hopefully I'll cast a little bit of light on the overall destructiveness of the Civil War in Indian Territory, a theater about which most historians know relatively little. In July of 1861, a small number, by the way, actually, before I get started, Creek Nation, just so you know, is right here, and it's one of the five tribes of Indian Territory, Creek, Cherokee, Choctaw, Chickasaw, and Seminole, so we know kind of where we're talking about. This is, of course, current Oklahoma. In July of 1861, a small number of wealthy, acculturated Creek leaders signed a treaty of alliance with the nascent Confederacy. With the eventual addition of the Cherokee Nation in September, all of the five tribes of Indian Territory allied with the Confederacy. This treaty, however, this Creek-Confederate treaty, represented the political desires of only a part of the Creek Nation, those who envisioned themselves as Southerners and who had adopted white Southern lifestyles and institutions. Many traditionalist, full-blooded Creek Indians, however, remained skeptical that an alliance with the Confederacy was in their best interest. And throughout the fall, thousands of Creek and Seminole Indians gathered under the leadership of Creek Chief Apothleohola in defiance of the Creek-Confederate alliance. Apothleohola was a natural leader to sort of lead this rebellion against Confederate authority. He had fought against Andrew Jackson at Horseshoe Bend, had vehemently opposed the illegal sale of Creek lands east of the Mississippi River in the 1830s, and so he is the one, and you see him here, who will resist the Confederate troopers throughout that winter. The 4,000 to 5,000 Native Americans who gathered under Apothleohola's leadership that fall voted with their feet, leaving their homes behind to mobilize under Apothleohola's leadership and to be free from Confederate authority. The Confederate commander in Indian Territory, Douglas Cooper, this gentleman right here, who, by the way, was the Indian agent to these tribes before the start. He was the federally appointed Indian agent to the Choctaw and Chickasaw tribes before the war started. So this is a federally appointed Indian agent who then switches to the Confederacy. Douglas Cooper determines that this challenge to Southern authority cannot stand, and he writes to, quote, either compel submission to the authorities or drive Apothleohola and his party from the country. Civil war had come to Indian Territory. Throughout November and December of 1861, Douglas Cooper and Apothleohola squared off against one another in the Creek and Cherokee nations. To give you a vague idea, there aren't very many good maps of Indian Territory, but these three men are going to fight a series of battles moving up from the Creek Nation through the Cherokee Nation towards, this is Kansas, of course, up here, and Fort Scott, Kansas in particular. So they're moving this way as they're battling one another. And since our time is limited, I'm not going to delve too deeply into the tactics of these battles, but I do want to hit the highlights and make note of a few items of importance. On November 19th, Apothleohola, with some 2,000 warriors and another several thousand civilians in tow, successfully repulsed the attacks of Confederate Colonel Douglas Cooper at the Battle of Round Mountain. Cooper, by the way, had some 1,400 soldiers under his command, including Confederate Indians from all of the five tribes, as well as white Texan cavalry troopers. Despite defeating Cooper, however, Apothleoholo withdrew during the night, likely concerned with protecting the thousands of noncombatants under his care. And this is really indicative of the entire military portion of this campaign. Apothleoholo is waging a fighting retreat, very nervous about protecting the civilians with him, so he's sort of slowly repulsing Confederate assaults, working his way north towards Union-held Kansas. And in retreating after the battle, Apothleoholo was forced to leave behind a dozen wagons, we are told, loaded with sugar, salt, coffee, and flour, as well as oxen, cattle, sheep, and ponies, all of which the Confederates found the next day. Also found the next day were the bodies of two Confederate soldiers that had been, quote, taken prisoner by them and beaten to death. George Griscom of the 9th Texas Cavalry watched as Confederate Creeks, quote, took some scalps, the first I ever saw. On December 8th, a few weeks later, Cooper again battles Apothleoholo on the banks of Bird Creek, or Chustotalasa, as the Indians call it, in Cherokee Nation, right about here, very close to Tulsa, actually. Once again, Apothleoholo emerged victorious in this exchange, in part due to the timely arrival of reinforcements. On the night before the battle, an entire regiment of Confederate Cherokee soldiers, the 1st Cherokee Mounted Rifles, proved themselves sympathetic to Apothleoholo's cause and defected to his lines in mass the night before the battle. This marks the only instance in the Civil War, by the way, where a Confederate regiment defects to the ostensibly Union side. There were 480 men in this regiment. The next morning, only 60 remained with the Confederate troopers. So after two battles, Douglas Cooper has been unable to defeat Apothleoholo, and he calls for outside help, which is, of course, a tacit admission of his failure thus far. And it was not Cooper's force, but instead the 1,600 Arkansan and Texan troopers under Colonel James McIntosh, who clashed with Apothleoholo at Chistinalaw on December 29th, the final battle of the campaign. Unlike Cooper's piecemeal attacks and previous engagements, McIntosh ordered his entire command into a headlong frontal assault that shattered the Unionist Indians' line. Beyond capturing another 30 wagons of provisions and hundreds of cattle, sheep, ponies, and oxen, Confederate soldiers this time also captured 160 women and children, 20 African Americans, who were, of course, returned to slavery, and one wounded warrior. Now, really, this should be the end of my story. This should be the end of the campaign, because as we are told, Cooper set out to either compel Apothleoholo's submission or drive them from the country. And after the Battle of Chistinalaw, Cooper has been decisively militarily defeated. His warriors are broken, and the thousands of people who had followed him, civilian and warriors alike, are fleeing north in scattered parties from northern Cherokee Nation towards the Kansan border. This is not, of course, the end of my story. The Confederate colonels on the ground, James McIntosh and Douglas Cooper, elected to pursue Apothleoholo's broken party further, despite the fact that they would now be hunting not only Apothleoholo's warriors, but also the women, children, and civilians who had followed him north. The nearly 5,000 followers of Apothleoholo had to cross nearly 300 miles of rocky, broken country in the dead of winter to reach the relative safety of the Verdigris River in Kansas, their ultimate destination. And along the way, these refugees faced challenges from both their Confederate pursuers and the environment alike. The Confederates constantly attacked the retreating Indians. During one such assault, 10-year-old Creek Indian James Scott witnessed a heart-rending scene, quote, "One time we saw a little baby on its blanket in the woods. Everyone was running because an attack was expected, and no one had the time to stop and pick up the child. As it saw the people running by, the little child began to wave its little hands. The child had no knowledge that he had been deserted." Not long after, Scott watched an even more horrific scene unfold. Quote, "Some women carrying children would be overtaken by Confederate soldiers, and the soldiers snatched the children from the arms of the mothers and smashed their heads against the trees." We can question whether this single incident of brutality took place, but there seems to be confirmation that, broadly speaking, this was an incredibly violent campaign. Stephen Foreman, who was a missionary to the Cherokees, relayed in his diary news given to him by soldiers, Confederate soldiers returning from the campaign, and he writes in January of 62, "They," the Confederate soldiers, "are just from Apothleoholo's camp, whether they went to give him, as they said, a brushing. It is estimated that they killed about 200 prisoners, including some women and children." as these Indians are fleeing north from their lives and trying to fend off the Confederate attackers, they also have to deal with the environment. If any of you have been to northeast Oklahoma, you'll know we think of Oklahoma as a plains state, which it sort of is. But this region of Oklahoma, you're basically in the foothills of the Boston Mountains and the Ozark Plateau. It's very hilly, very rugged, broken country. The weather at this time was bitterly cold. One Indian agent called it, quote, the most severe that occurred in that part of the country for many years. James Bates of the 9th Texas, one of the pursuers, wrote in his diary that in the morning it was, quote, cold enough to freeze my breath on my mustache. And indeed, James McIntosh, in his after-action report, writes that his men, and thus Apothleohola's followers, had to march on, quote, ground covered with snow, and at other times facing the chilly blasts from the north. So it's rugged country, it's bitterly cold, and now is when we need to remember that these Indians had lost their provisions time and again throughout the campaign. All of those wagons of food and supplies, all of their tents, all of their ponies, all of their oxen, they had lost this throughout the military portion of the campaign in Apothleohola's retreating. So they are largely without the provisions necessary to make this journey. One Indian tells us, quote, we faced many hardships. We were often without food. The children cried from weariness and cold. We fled and left our wagons with much-needed provisions, clothing, and other necessities. When our provisions went low, some of the members of the tribe turned to eating horse flesh. Lindy Scott heard stories from her family of how, quote, the leg, arms, toes, and fingers of some of the Indians were lost by being frozen, and they would have to be amputated in the best manner possible. As these Indians finally completed their 300-mile trek north to the Verdigris River, where refugee camps awaited them, the sad state prompted U.S. Indian agent George Cutler to state very simply, I doubt much if history records an instance of sufferings equal to these. Now, I hope that this sad tale has proved interesting to you. I hope it has piqued your interest in Indian territory. But I want to end my talk today by grappling with some fundamental questions, which is, why does this story matter, right? Why should you care? And why should historians of the Civil War pay any attention to Indian territory, a relative political and military backwater? And I would submit to you, these are tough questions. I don't know if my answers answer them wholly, but I want to submit to you some ideas. To begin with, there is a sheer human element to this story that I think is worthy of being told. We don't know how many Indians died along this trek north that winter, although undoubtedly many did. But we do know that during the Civil War, one quarter of the Creek Nation, 2,500 individuals, would perish. Among the Cherokee, the war was even more destructive. One third of the tribe, 7,500 individuals, would die. One in four Cherokee children were orphans by war's end. Two-thirds of Indian Territory's 1860 population were refugees by 1865. 30,000 people were refugees by the end of the war, completely dependent upon others for their sustenance by 1865. These numbers are massive, and they speak to the wholesale destruction of Indian Territory and the traumatic experience that the Civil War unfortunately provided for these tribes. And this destruction needs to be explored by Civil War historians and explained by Civil War historians. And I think the campaign against Apothleohola gives us some hints as to how this devastation could arise. First off, I would argue that the campaign against Apothleohola represents an early appearance of hard war, although it's sort of a unique instance of hard war, right? Because this is, we think of hard war as the Union military punishing the Confederacy, as we've heard. But this is really the Confederacy attacking Union forces, and really, by the end of the campaign, attacking Union civilians, Indian civilians. So if we go back to Cooper's claim to either compel submission or drive Apothleohola from the country, we know that his intent is to undercut Indian morale, to force them to toe the Confederate line or get them out of Indian territory, which he does rather effectively. In particular, the decision to pursue Apothleohola's party after the defeat of Apothleohola at Chustenalaw, I think, is noteworthy, because that pursuit after the battle was one where really they're pursuing civilians, not an organized military force. And I would argue, and I think actually Leanne White sort of made reference to this last night, that the brutality of this campaign was only possible because it was conducted far from centers of power, and the oversight of Confederate politicians, generals, or the press was not there. So for the same reason that historians have ignored Indian territory, right, it's a military backwater, it's a political backwater, for the same reasons we ignore it today, the press and politicians of the time ignored it back then, and it allows something like this to happen largely unnoticed, and we need to notice it. And it also suggests that hard war emerges from the frontier, right? It emerges first in these areas far from centers of power, and then sort of boils up and pollinates and creeps into the larger theaters of war. But I want to also end by saying that in this case in particular, perhaps the roots of this campaign are also due to the unique racial and cultural divisions implicit in the Civil War in Indian Territory. I wonder, for example, if Confederate forces would have smashed the heads of white babies against the trees during this campaign. So there's certainly an element of race and racism that has to be accounted for. But moreover, I think, and this would be sort of my final note, the more I study this topic, the more I am convinced that the Civil War in Indian Territory is, in fact, an Indian Civil War that is both a part of and a part from the wider American Civil War. And I think scholars need to continue to explore this sort of dissonance. We need to place Indian agency at the forefront of this story, because I wonder if the tremendous sort of destruction of this campaign is due, in fact, to the political and cultural divisions, these deep-seated problems within the Native American tribes of Indian Territory. So I would end by simply saying, look west. Thank you.
All right. So first, I'd like to thank Andrew and Joe and Zach for writing and presenting three really evocative papers. And for inviting me to comment on them. I have already sent the panelists quite detailed comments, which they loved, on their papers. And given that you have just sat here and listened to them kind of present their very tightly argued pieces of work, I'm not going to summarize them, and I'm not going to critique them individually. What I am going to do is offer a few comments, kind of positioning these papers within a current debate about guerrilla warfare and its place in military history, and talk about how I think these papers push us to think about the Civil War a bit differently than we're used to thinking about it, and why that is a good thing. So, as some of you may know, there have been some recent kerfuffles regarding the place of military history within Civil War studies, and then the place of guerrilla warfare within that military history. Anyone who was present at the Southern last year at the military history panel knows that it exploded quite spectacularly into a gigantic shouting match. And as part of this debate, some historians, Gary Gallagher most prominently and loudly, have been very dismissive of guerrilla warfare studies, among many other subfields, for two reasons. First, and I'm just going to, because Gary is joined by several other people, and I'm just going to refer to them as the Gallagher Group, which sounds sort of like a consulting firm, but that's how I will refer to them. So first, the Gallagher Group contends that guerrilla warfare in the regions in which it proliferated, the border counties of Kansas, Missouri, Indian Territory, and Western Virginia, were ancillary to the overall conflict. These activities were rarely sanctioned or integrated into the campaigns of larger armies, and these regions were not major theaters of the war. Therefore, this argument goes, such activities were trivial, and any emphasis on them is a practice in the aggrandizement of the irregular. The second critique is that attention to guerrilla warfare inappropriately emphasizes what we have come to refer to as the dark history of the war, voicing the victim's narrative, positioning it within a culture of violence, and arguing that psychological devastation was an important wartime experience. And the Gallagher Group argues that these particular experiences were actually anomalies, and therefore unimportant. The three papers that you have heard today, I think, quite effectively argue against the Gallagher Group and its critiques, and they each offer some really compelling and original ways to engage with the war's military and social histories. So first, all of these papers help us think about the relationship between fighting forces in the field in new ways. And I think through his mapping methodologies, Andrew sort of points this out sort of most overtly in his paper, discovering that temporary Union occupation at different sites in Missouri instigated Confederate guerrilla responses, and that guerrillas cooperated to some extent with Confederate armies in the field and relied upon their conventional actions. Thus, you know, I think his study really helps us to connect the strategies and the tactics of the irregular and the regular in new ways. I think we're used to talking about horses only when they are dead or famous, right? As subjects of photographs or as challenges for burial teams. But Joe's focus on the tactical advantages of horsemanship in guerrilla bands also prompts us to make connections between irregular fighters and conventional armies through their shared use of and reliance upon these animals, not only in cavalry operations, but also in foraging and horse raiding expeditions that characterized hard war in the larger armies in all regions. Second, all of these papers argue that the border region, and Missouri in particular, and Indian Territory were important areas in the Confederacy's long-term military and political plans. And I think for those of us who are the writers and teachers of the Civil War era, we always talk about the West when we talk about the antebellum era, right? Like, this is where we're talking about the Mexican-American War, we're talking about the Transcontinental Railroad, we're talking about Indian Territory and kind of Kansas-Nebraska Act and all of these things that sort of enhance sectionalism and sort of bring the nation to warfare. And then we get to the war and we ignore this region completely. It just disappears. And it doesn't emerge again until 1877 when soldiers go west and start fighting Indians, right? There's sort of this blank space where the West is. We should not abandon this region because this region was a crucial component of both Union and Confederate military and political activities between 1861 and 1865. This region was a crossroads of trade through which provisions that were absolutely necessary to the war effort, particularly cotton and cattle, were moving constantly throughout the war. It was also a region that both sides, but particularly the Confederacy, integrated into their visions of themselves, both present and future. So if we're going to argue that the Union was a pivotal concept for Northern soldiers and civilians, and that Confederate nationalism was significant in shaping the Southern wartime experience, then we must recognize the centrality of the border region and the far West to both of these ideologies. And I think Zach's paper makes these points most directly. The Confederacy's pursuit of Opothleyahola's band suggests the control of the Trans-Mississippi West and points westward was vital for the Confederacy. They wanted to secure that territory for multiple reasons. And all of these papers show that control over the region, particularly because of the absence of large armies in the field, was always contested throughout the war in a number of different ways and by a range of communities. All of this conflict created this culture of violence in the region. And this is a term that the Gallagher Group has a specific problem with because they think it is too broad. I disagree with that completely. Because I think we need to think about warfare expansively. Violence does not just occur on the battlefield, like within the lines of those maps, right? Like, oh, then no other violence was happening off the page, right? We need to acknowledge that Civil War Americans experienced violence in many different contexts and in many different ways. Now, it is true that acts of violence and cases of extreme suffering were sometimes unrelated to battlefield engagements. But as Zach shows us in his paper, violence and suffering occurred both in the context of battle and in its wake, creating these refugee populations that are in crisis. And just because these experiences were not directly connected to military actions in the Eastern Theater does not mean they were not indirectly connected, and it certainly does not mean that they were unimportant. Also, if we think about these violent interactions in this region as part of a larger culture of violence, they cease to be anomalies, right? And are, in fact, an integral part of the wartime experience. Third and finally, these papers, and I think most particularly Andrew's, reveal how useful innovative methodologies can be in producing knowledge about the Civil War era for telling us something that we had not known before. So just as people say, can we write anything new about the Civil War at this point? Another question is, are there any other sources besides letters and diaries, newspapers, and the OR? You know, and this question of sources is, I think, something that Leanne was talking about last night in her talk. As some of you may know, I'm a big advocate for using visual culture, newspaper illustrations, political cartoons, lithographs, and photographs as sources in Civil War studies. And so I wonder, sort of, how did, I mean, Joe showed us this great illustration of this man's perception of himself on horseback, and I'm also wondering, where else did horses appear in wartime visual culture, right? I mean, they had to be in the pages of Harper's Weekly. Where did they appear in depictions of both guerrillas and soldiers in other armies? Because that could be another connection between them, too. And did Native Americans in the Indian Territory enter the visual record in any kind of wartime publications or in lithographs? If so, in what ways did they appear? And how is Native American participation in the war depicted at the time versus being largely forgotten now? I'm also wondering if the Army produced any maps at the time of guerrilla actions in territories as a way to kind of understand where they were going to have to respond, or if this helped kind of Northerners and Southerners imagine the region in new ways. If there are any sort of maps out there already depicting irregular military actions versus conventional actions. And what about Native oral histories in studies of the Indian Territory? Zach uses, if you see his paper online, you can look at his footnotes, and he uses the records of the Commissioners of Indian Affairs, which are really, really useful. And I think this is an untapped source for military histories in this region, and I'm hoping that Zach can maybe tell us a little bit more about both those and then also the Indian Pioneer Papers, which he uses as documentation. And then the last question I'd like to pose here for us today and then for the rest of the conference maybe is, how could Andrew's mapping technique be used both not only in these two other excellent studies to illuminate kind of new patterns or developments in mounted battles or in movements of soldiers and civilians through Indian Territory, or how might we all use this kind of mapping technique in other studies that we'll be talking about kind of later today and tomorrow. So in the end, I think the papers in this panel, and I'm sure, again, the papers we'll hear later today and tomorrow, really prove that studies of guerrilla warfare might appear to some people to be marginal, but they are actually central to the project of understanding the experiences of all Americans during the Civil War. Thank you. Okay, so now I think we have about 15 minutes for questions for our panelists. So when you raise your hand and I'll acknowledge you, and then please introduce yourself and before you ask your question.
Yeah, my name is Steve Lindsay. I'm not exactly a historian, more of a reenactor. said that the force that was raised by Cooper was mostly Indians. So maybe my question is even kind of moot. It seems useless for the Confederacy to expend any resources on a territory that wasn't even a state.
Well, so I guess if you're sort of asking why the Confederacy and why are they expending these resources? So they are and they aren't. Really, what I would tell you is the Confederacy has limited interest in Indian territory, but Texas and Arkansas are incredibly interested in Indian territory. Indian territory is a neighbor. In the secession crisis, and sort of as states are seceding in '61. There are literally Texan mobs roaming north into Indian territory to kick out northern abolitionist missionaries. There are Texan mobs sitting in the halls of these Indian nations' general councils when they secede. There are bodies of Arkansans, everyday citizens, writing to Indian chiefs saying, where are your loyalties, right? They're immensely worried about what their Indian neighbors are going to do in the coming Civil War. And that's why, the only Southern regiments I can think of that are white that serve in Indian territory are Texan and Arkansan. So it's really, nationally, I think there's a limited sort of interest, but regionally, Indian territory is critical to these Texans and Arkansans.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
In the red shirt?
Michael Ryan from Urbana University, formerly University of Cincinnati. This is why I came here, was to hear the hoofbeats and smell the sweat of the horses and everything. And immediately, all three of these papers made me think of Forrest Carter. And so, suspending Forrest Carter's ideology, Joe, have you read Gone to Texas? You should. Because the graphic descriptions of taking care of the horses,
right.
Feeding the horses oats, because oats would make them stronger and faster. All of these things. I mean, Carter really captures that guerrilla experience in his own way. He's got his own agenda, of course, and it's a lost cause agenda in a lot of ways. The movie's fun too, The Outlaw Josie Wells,
yeah.
But the book has all of these details about living in the brush and that symbiotic relationship between the horse and the rider, and also about the big Colt's pistols and all of those kinds of things. But you gotta read that.
I absolutely will, thank you. I've seen the movie only 47 times.
Not hard to track. We just did, man.
We had a question over here. No?
I could have.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I also have a question for Joe regarding kind of this horse mentality among the guerrillas. Especially, I'm interested in masculinity because this has already taken place in the context of such a martial event, which of course makes it very easy to take claims for masculinity. So, what is the horse aspect of this? Where does the horse kind of extend masculinity beyond simply military service? How is masculinity really being formed for these people in comparison to general soldiers?
Right. Well, I think there's a couple components. One part is this, in addition to just being an issue of masculinity or man, it's also an issue of class, right? These are a certain type of men. These are men from elite families. Most of these men have slaves. Not a ton, but their families have slaves. So to have another man tell them to get off their horses to join the regular or the Missouri, State Guard or the regular Confederate Army, and then march and be ordered to do stuff by a man on horseback was just, it was literally a low man. Horses elevated them above women, above slaves, quite literally. So that has a lot to do with this handheld culture. Additionally, this image of the knight, as romantic and silly and fanciful as it is to us, was something that they were actively thinking about. Maybe not all of them, but a lot of these guys knew stories and thought about themselves in this way. The only way they could do it is like charging headlong, right? I will say, though, they spent the vast majority of their
charging headlong to stop.
Yes.
Can I squeeze in two questions?
Just one for now. We'll get back to you.
All right, well, I'll go with Andy then. Could you talk a little bit more about cause and effect? Because I was kind of wondering, I know your paper's, there's a lot more information, but is it always that the Union garrison then brings out the guerrillas, or is it that, or the Union activity, or do you have guerrillas and then you send in the Union activity? So in other words, do they kind of build upon one another?
Differs from a Confederate cavalryman and his relationship with his horse. one way in which I do think that they might be different is the maybe immediate familiarity with the animals themselves. So a lot of these Confederate cavalrymen go off to war on horses that they own, right? Horses that they, you know, raised and broken and all of this. And eventually those horses get killed and they're hundreds of miles from home and they're, you know, they have to sort of, you know, learn how to ride with a new horse, break a new horse. And I think that the gorillas are surrounded by a horse population that has grown up on the same farms that they have. And so they know these horses, they know the horses by parents, you know, who sired them, et cetera. That would be the only difference, but I really think that there's a very, there's a similar relationship between the two groups, between these elite Confederate cavalrymen and the gorillas.
My name's Adam Dami, UNC, Chapel Hill. My question is for Andrew, and hopefully this isn't too technical as a fellow GIS user. How did you categorize acts of violence in the sense of, if I go down the street and kill three people, is that one event or three? And in finding those events, how much of the correlation that you found might be a product of source bias? Because the murder that happens against a civilian in northern, the north end of the state or the south end of the state isn't going to show up in Union records or probably Confederate records.
Okay. Glad you asked both of these questions because I want to talk about both of them. I'll start with your second one. For sources, sorry, Adam, I can't see you. For sources, I use the ones that Leanne talked about last night. If you were here last night, she talked about the Missouri Union Provost Marshal records. So, in addition to everything Leanne talked about, a gorilla came to my house and threatened me and stole my horse, stole a bunch of food. I could go to the provost marshal and tell them what happened. And we had that record. I wanted to understand the guerrilla war from the civilian perspective first. Right now, I am desperately trying to go to the OR and do the same thing, try to do both. But I started with the provost marshal records, and I started with primary and secondary accounts of Quantrill and Anderson and these infamous gorillas. As far as categorizing acts of violence, I built this whole thing in a program called Meatwalk. I had big circles for based on the deaths of the act of violence and small circles. And when I rebuilt the whole map in ArcGIS, this map that I showed completely leaves the level of violence out of it. So as you know, these maps are always changing, and I have not gone back to my original the original map where I sort of try to spatially resemble. You know, there's a difference between a massacre where 120 people are dying and some teenager getting his horse stolen from him. If you have a
Okay, we have time for one more question. So who wants to take it? Yes, sir.
Bob Barber, old time Purdue guy. I'm curious about what percentage of the gorillas were took off from the war. Is it a very high percentage or a low percentage?
Yes, I really do not. I feel like numbers are your thing. I mean, the honest answer is we really don't know. In the groups that I've looked at, I would say that about half the guys are killed by the end of the war. Matt, do you have any numbers on that?
Well, I think you would really need to backtrack a little bit and decide what you were actually saying constituted a guerrilla. Are we talking about Morgan and Mosby, you know, within the ranks of Parks and Rangers and Cavalry Raiders? Are we talking about the best known, like Quantrill and Anderson? Or are we talking about the teenager who randomly just robs his neighbor and we sort of decide that he's a bushwhacker on the neighborhood level? If you count all of them, I would say at least 50%. But it could be way more. We have really no way of knowing.
Yeah. I mean, it's just there's so few records that, you know, so in working with what we have, I mean, my first inclination would say half for the guys that I have, you know, been able to identify and study.
Because didn't the government pass a regulation to kill it?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep.
And therefore, it was open season. choosing on them as time went on.
Right, doesn't mean they did a very good job.
Right. It took a little while. All right, thank you very much. We'll take a break.